before we cut our cords, and streaming was years away. You could only binge on old DVDs, and seasons didn't last one day. But how did we cope? The weekly wait was such a tease. With the 2-hour block of shows, we could endure with ease. On every Thursday, could tune into NBC. Travel to Dundee, Mifflin, Greendale, TGS, San Pawnee. They stopped calling him a sea, but it was still a beautiful sight. So now I'm talking Comedy Night, and it's Podcasted Right.
Welcome to the Comedy Night Podcasted Right Christmas special. I'm Matt Kale, and I got your name this year for Secret Santa, and this podcast is your gift. I'm continuing this weird and wonderful journey through the all-too-brief moment in time, Community, Parks and Recreation, The Office, and 30 Rock all aired new episodes on the same night. On today's episode, we've come to the 2009 fall finales in 4 holiday episodes, originally airing on December 10th, 2009. Community, Season 1, Episode 12, Comparative Religion, Parks and Recreation, Season 2, Episode 12, Christmas Scandal, The Office, Season 6, Episode 13, Secret Santa, and 30 Rock, Season 4, Episode 8, also called Secret Santa. It's weird enough that two shows have the exact same episode title on the same night, but that's just one of the few weird coincidences that's going to crop up today. Considering how much I love forcing connections, having these ones come natural feels like a Christmas miracle. Now, I love the long-standing TV tradition of the holiday episode, and I feel like a lot of series really try to make these some of their best episodes. Episodes like Seinfeld's The Strike, where we learned all about Festivus. While Festivus was loosely based on a holiday that Seinfeld writer Dan O'Keefe's father created back in the 70s, it was Seinfeld's writing staff that converted it into an alternative for Christmas. And more specifically, writer Jeff Schaefer is credited with creating the concept of the Festivus Pole. I've never found a good opportunity to mention this before, but Jeff Schaefer is the co-creator and the main writer of The League. And you can draw a straight line between a joke like the aluminum Festivus Pole and the bizarre kind of humor we see on The League. Not to mention, we've already seen some great holiday episodes from The Office and 30 Rock already in their runs. So how will this year's offerings compare? And how will Community and Parks make out on their first attempts? Let's find out, but first.
This is the Comedy Night Podcasted Right Olds. If it was new, we call it news, but it's old, so we call it Olds.
On this day, December 10th, 2009, a little movie called Avatar held its official premiere in London before its wide release a week later. In its original run, it made $2.79 billion in worldwide box office gross, the all-time record that it held until the release of Avengers Endgame. You know that little movie that's been made by those Russo brothers I keep talking about every week? Avatar was re-released in theaters in China a few months ago and has managed to just creep back into first place, ahead of Endgame, for now. I'll wager a bold guess that you saw Avatar during your winter break in 2009. 3D movies were starting to trend again, and by this point, they all looked terrible. But director James Cameron innovated new filming techniques to actually make 3D look good. And this movie was visually stunning, and completely reinvented what could be done with the medium. The hype around Avatar was that you had to see this movie in 3D in theater. It was pretty standard small talk for everybody, even Nancy Donovan, who we'll meet for the first time later tonight.
Hey, how you doing? You see Avatar?
Yeah, that new 3D is amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. I found myself rooting for our boys in uniform, not those blue hippies. But full disclosure, I had a couple of drinks prior, too.
It's a rare thing for a movie to become that popular just because it looked so good, let alone become the highest grossing movie of all time. You go down the rest of the list of high-grossing films, and everything else is either a remake, a sequel, adaptation based on historical events, or it's a Disney feature-length film. Avatar was its own thing.
Hey, Wesley, have you seen Avatar? I never saw Avatar. I wanted to read the book first, but then I realized there's no book version of Avatar.
But do you remember what Avatar is about? Have you ever rewatched it? I was going to just for this segment, but oh, it is so long. Other than that first time in theaters, I think I may have caught part of it on TV once. I mostly just remember that they're trying to get a mineral called unobtainium, which, despite its name, is almost unobtainable. I guarantee you that more people spend more time watching Community, Parks and Recreation, The Office, and 30 Rock today, or any day, than they did watching Avatar. I always cut weird stories about my personal life during 2009 out of this podcast due to time constraints, but I want to tell this short one because 8 episodes in, and I figure you'll indulge me as a Christmas present. At this point in my life, I'm working rotational shift work, alternating between 2 weeks of day shifts and 2 weeks of night shifts. I was in manufacturing, so my workplace held a lot of wellness seminars and safety trainings, but no one ever felt the need to climb up on the roof to try to jump onto a bouncy castle to prove their point. But this one day, they brought in a nutritionist, and she had some pretty good advice for healthy eating habits for shift workers that I myself followed for years. Near the end of her presentation, she was driving home the point that unnecessary stress on your digestive system can create what's called free radical cells. Other cells think free radicals are just normal cells, but they can damage healthy cells and they can lead to disease if your immune system doesn't destroy them. If you got bored by that sentence, so were all my coworkers. So this nutritionist is trying to rope us back in. She starts out with, "You guys saw Avatar, right? You know, free radicals are just like that movie." Now I'm super excited because, hell yes, I'm down for learning a lesson via a pop culture reference. I'm thinking she'll refer to the first 2.5 hours of that movie, where the space marine inhabits an alien body, and then he goes running around pretending he's a good guy and looks like all the other aliens, but his mission is to actually ruin everything and obtain unobtainium. Pretty much exactly how she's described how free radicals behave up until this point. No, instead she says, "You know, it's just like, the end of that movie when the bad guy gets into that big suit of armor and runs around trying to kill people and break stuff. That robot suit looked like a person, but it was actually a bad guy inside doing bad stuff." It's been like 11 years since I heard this, and I am still convinced she was telling a joke that only I got. It was an effective lesson, I guess, since I barely can remember the rest of the plot of Avatar, but she made such a clunky and terrible pop cultural reference that I still know what a free radical cell is. I'm going to take a lesson from that nutritionist, and tonight I'll only be linking everything back to Avatar via what I vaguely and probably incorrectly remember about the movie.
This is what everyone watched instead.
It's not quite a Christmas miracle, but ratings are up across the board on Comedy Night Done Right. Community's up to 5.51 million viewers, its best number in several weeks. Parks and Recreation is up to 4.9 million. The Office had 8.51 million viewers, one of the best numbers since Jim and Pam got married. And 6.7 million for 30 Rock is the best ratings they got this season so far. Even Jay Leno's hot tonight, with 5 million tuning in to see Matt Damon. If you can hold on for just 13 more episodes of Comedy Night Podcasted Right, we'll finally see him appear in the season 4 finale of 30 Rock. So for once, NBC actually beat ABC in the ratings.
Yes, but those ratings mean nothing.
That's right, Liz, because ABC was only airing reruns, since all of their shows have already had their fall finales. And because ABC was airing reruns, everyone else ended up getting higher ratings too. On Fox, Bones had 10.9 million viewers at 8 o'clock with The Goop on the Girl, with the team investigating a botched bank robbery where the robber was disguised as Santa Claus and accidentally blew himself up.
Oh. Burning.
Oh my God.
We got a live one. On fire.
Fringe aired Grey Matters at 10, with 6.3 million viewers, and has slipped back behind 30 Rock in the ratings. The plot is once again incomprehensible out of context, but it had something to do with people swapping brains.
So right now,
I'm you, and you're me.
Oh my god, this is wrinkling my brain!
CBS would actually continue new episodes this week and next, giving them free rein to crush the ratings. Survivor had 13.25 million viewers this week, aired its penultimate episode next week, and then the finale aired on Sunday, December 20th. I was so excited for Survivor to be over, because I'm running out of ideas for drops, only to find out that another season will start up again in February.
I mean, you're the one who insisted on hiring American engineers. All they teach us now is how to build roller coasters and Survivor challenges.
CSI had the highest viewership tonight with appendectocytement with 16.43 million viewers. Nick, Greg, and Hodges kidnap Henry to celebrate his birthday at a barbecue restaurant, but end up stranded up in the building with a dead body.
They have one that's called the Meat Tornado. Literally killed a guy last year.
You had me at Meat Tornado.
The Mentalist finished slightly behind with 16.37 million viewers, tuning in to A Price Above Rubies, which guest starred both Fred Ox, who was Tom's key smith in Park's beauty pageant that aired earlier this season, and E.J. Callahan, who will go on to play the old prospector in Community's Paradigms of Human Memories.
Glad you had fun. By the way, that dude was hardcore racist, like 1800s Disney style. We learned new ways to hate ourselves.
Over on FX, we're getting some season finales. Season 5 of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia ended with The Gang Reignites the Rivalry, which got 1.68 million viewers. Remember this for later on, but this episode was, like so many Always Sunnies this season, directed by Randall Einhorn. So say goodbye, since it'll be September 2010 before we see any more It's Always Sunny in
Philadelphia.
The league's first season ended with the Shiva Bowl getting 1.2 million viewers at 10:30. The league managed to get an early Christmas present as it was announced on this day that the show would be getting a second season, and it's coming back next fall too.
This is by far the most destructive season ever. And I cannot wait to play next year because I shall be victorious!
No.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Unfortunately, other than seeing some Christmas trees in the background of the league, neither of those episodes were holiday themed at all. But hold on to your Yule logs, because we've got a 2-hour block of festive fun coming up.
For we caught up colds and streaming was years away. We only binge on old DVDs and season didn't last one day. Stop going in my seat, it was still a beautiful sight. Now I'm talking gone.
Comparative Religion is the first of 8 episodes directed by Adam Davison. So much talk about the highest grossing movies of all time, and this is the week where the Russos weren't involved? Anyways, Liz Kakowski, who played the guidance counselor last week on Community, wrote this, her second of 2 episodes. The dean is announcing over the PA that they're holding a religiously neutral winter wonderland in the quad for the last day of classes, and the dean himself is getting dressed up in what I believe is our first extravagant costume, the non-denominational Mr. Winner. Everything we know about Shirley so far is going to play into tonight's episode. She's a divorced Christian mother with some severely repressed rage issues. After hearing the loudspeaker announcement in the cafeteria, Shirley is annoyed.
I'm so sick of the dean jamming his PC-ness down my throat.
Pierce, I'd like to commend you for letting that one go.
PC-ness.
Now we go. It sounds like penis. That's just gotta do.
This reminds Shirley to give everyone their handmade What Would Baby Jesus Do bracelets because it's Christmas, and the group reluctantly puts them on to make her happy. Meanwhile, Abed inadvertently makes an enemy when he takes all the Winter Doodle cookies for his friends. After weeks of passing homages to The Breakfast Club, we finally get one of the film stars, Anthony Michael Hall, as a guest star on Community, with the fun twist being that he gets to play the overbearing bully Mike instead of the nerd like he did in The Breakfast Club. Mike flips Abed's plate of cookies, leading Jeff to step in, and things escalate quickly.
Knock, knock. My fist up your balls.
Who's there?
But Mr. Winter shows up, and Mike's not about to start a fight in front of the dean. The study group is asking Jeff why didn't he punch Mike.
For the same reason that I floss, have a bed frame, and keep my guitar in its case. I'm over 23.
Shirley's very happy he turned the other cheek. Abed's having movie reference overload. Pierce claims that fighting is hardwired in men for dominance and mating. And Britta thinks it's all pent-up, repressed homosexual tendencies. Jeff's only worried about cramming to pass the Spanish final because he has done no extra credit work, so that would have required doing extra work. As Shirley continues to plan her Christmas party, she learns just how diverse the study group actually is. Annie's Jewish, Abed's Muslim, Troy's a Jehovah's Witness, and Britta is an atheist. Jeff, knowing a discussion on religion will only distract them all from studying, tries to kill the conversation, but then admits he's an agnostic.
Agnostic. Lazy man's atheist.
Pierce, as we come to find out, is in a quasi-Buddhist space cult. Shirley, a little shook and believing the Lord is testing her, clings on and agrees to open up the party to all of their faiths. During the Spanish 101 final, Chang is ready to GTFO for break and is barely invigilating the test when Mike spots Jeff from the hallway and comes into the classroom to taunt him some more.
Senior Chang, can you do something about this?
I'll allow it.
Enough is enough, and Jeff takes no sleeves up on his challenge to fight. Britta continues to believe this is all homoerotic nonsense. Abed's excited about having a bodyguard, and Shirley missed all of this because she had already handed in her exam. While strategizing for the fight, it's agreed that they won't tell Shirley about it because it's only going to trigger a guilt trip. We learn that Jeff's never been in a fight since no one has ever tried to fight him before.
I guess I'm too charming and likable. Call me a name.
I can't. Mm.
Jeff's confident that he's strong enough to win a fight, but when Mike shows up and staples a snowman onto his face, Jeff realizes that he's actually going to need some fight lessons from the other guys. Jeff goes off to train secretly, and Troy teaches Jeff the importance of crazy eyes, while Pierce teaches Jeff to expect a dirty fight. Shirley catches them, since Annie slipped up earlier and told her about the fight, and no one can think of a cover story on the spot.
We're trying to get Jeff ready for the fight. I couldn't think of another word.
Idiot.
Due to everything going on in her personal life, this is the only Christmas party Shirley will hold this year. It's important to her, and she feels like Jeff's fight is insulting to her and her faith as well. Jeff tries to explain he's just sticking up for Abed, and a little bit for his own hurt feelings. But Shirley gives him the ultimatum that Jeff can pick the fight or the party, and Jeff called it. It's a guilt trip.
Come on, Shirley, don't be mad.
I'm not mad, I'm disappointed.
That's mom for mad.
Everybody else goes to the party instead of the fight, since Jeff can hold his own. But despite saying that she would open the party up to everyone's beliefs, Shirley guilt trips and patronizes the rest of the study group. Just like Jeff also called earlier in Act 1, a discussion on religion devolves into a massive argument, and Britta's the first to pump the brakes. She's sorry that this is Shirley's first Christmas without her family, and this group can be a second family for her, but that support needs to flow in all directions. And right now, Britta is going to support Jeff rolling around and groping another man on the ground, and this leads to a mass exodus out to the quad. Greendale is supposed to be in Colorado, and Mike's out here in short sleeves in December. When Jeff puts up his fist to fight, he notices he's still wearing Shirley's WWBJD bracelet. Jeff has a change of heart and realizes he should be making peace, since that's what Shirley would do. But, just like Pierce called it, Mike fights dirty and sucker punches him. Jeff's still trying to be the pacifist, but when Shirley shows up and sees what Jeff is dealing with...
Jeffrey? Kick his ass!
Jeffrey's here! Shirts off, boys!
To use some hockey terminology, Mike's crew goes tarps off and a brawl breaks out. And it only lasts about 45 seconds on screen, but hot damn, it is a well-shot fight scene. Even Shirley's out here swinging foreign objects, leading to one of community's great memeable moments.
Please, it's Christmas!
It's December 10th!
Whether or not they actually won the fight, or it was just a moral victory is irrelevant, and the study group finally gathers for the party, bruised and bloody. Chang shows up to tell the study group he's done grading exams, which just goes to show how much he's mailing it in, because they only finished writing those like a couple of hours ago. It's great news because everybody passed.
Except for Jeff. Oh. Turns out you, pause for dramatic effect, will be seeing me next semester.
No!
In Spanish 102! Because he passed.
Yeah. Oh,
and I'm the only Spanish teacher?
Yay! I meant about Jeff passing. You being our Spanish teacher.
Any excuse for me to use an Annie scream. Obviously, this is Community's first holiday episode since it's season one. And this episode often gets overshadowed by what they did in the next two seasons. While certainly far less ambitious than what would come, it's a very fun episode nonetheless. One thing I've immediately picked up on is that this episode is one without multiple plots. While I truly love how Community interweaves plots the way they usually do, I don't think this episode was any worse for it. My only criticism is that the rest of the study group is just kind of there, and we're seeing them play out their already defined roles. Pierce wants to mentor Jeff, while Troy wants to impress Jeff. Annie's mostly here just to remind people to
say the whole word
when referring to Jewish people. We're also beginning to see Britta's ineptitude at psychoanalyzing what everyone else is doing around her. And Abed, he's just excited that this is checking off half a dozen different movie tropes. It's a great use of a great guest star in Anthony Michael Hall. It's a bit of a shame that we don't get to see the original Rusty Griswold pair up with Chevy Chase for anything significant. Now, if the Rusty from Christmas Vacation had shown up, who was Johnny Galecki, would have blown my mind. But just as a frame of reference, Johnny Galecki and the Big Bang Theory Christmas episode that would air 4 days after this got 15.6 million viewers. So Johnny's probably doing fine without a Community guest spot. At least a few years down the line, Hall, Chase, and a few other iterations of the Griswold kids got together for a Christmas Old Navy ad in 2012. Anyways, it's Shirley who gets the most character growth out of this episode, learning that she needs to be tolerant and respectful to get that same respect given back to her. And while Jeff's fight with Mike, I guess, is the B-plot, it really just serves as a counterpoint to everything that Shirley is doing. Jeff, the agnostic, doesn't want to fight, and it's his actions that are preaching peace and tolerance. But we've seen Abed refer to Shirley's thinly veiled rage issues before, so it's not surprising when we see her blow off some frustration in the fight. All in all, this episode teaches us exactly the same thing that Avatar did. Being peaceful doesn't work. And after getting taunted for hours, it's okay to band together with your friends to open up some cans of whoop-ass. Again, I can't stress enough that I did not rewatch Avatar. Christmas Scandal is the third of 10 episodes written by series co-creator Michael Schur, who I've talked about plenty already. This was the first of five parks to be directed by none other than Randall Einhorn, who I've also talked about plenty, especially already in this episode, since he also directed tonight's It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Considering how linear Community was tonight, Parks was all over the place, bringing us back to quite a few story arcs and characters that we haven't seen for weeks, and jamming a lot of story into 22 minutes. We open at the Pawnee City Government Follies, an event that's one part Christmas pageant, one part roast, and the Parks Department is hosting. Leslie spoofs Councilman Dexart, who's constantly embroiled in sex scandals, only to get a message from him after the show saying that he wants to speak with her in private. Leslie thinks this is foolish, and she barely picked on him at all.
He got off easy. And often. Thank you, I'll be here all week.
When Leslie meets with Dexart, it turns out she accidentally predicted the latest scandal that's about to break. He knocked up his babysitter, and while she was giving birth, he had a fivesome in a supply closet with some nurses and a woman whose husband was getting a liver transplant. Dexart wants Leslie's source.
Which one of them told you? Was it the liver lady?
Leslie is shocked, saying she was just kidding around, and Dexart quickly realizes that she's telling the truth and tries to play this whole thing off as a prank. But the Pawnee Sun tabloid got a picture of this secret meeting and runs it on the front page, with the headline, Sexy Dexy Strikes Again. Pert Hapley is reporting on the issue.
And although they left separately, no one knows where they woke up together.
And now all of Pawnee thinks Dexart and Leslie are having an affair. Leslie meets up with her boyfriend, Officer Dave, who I keep forgetting about since we haven't seen him since Halloween. Dave doesn't believe any of this scandal, and he's actually got some big news of his own. His Army Reserve unit got called up, and he'll be stationed in San Diego for the next 18 months. Dave's in love and wants Leslie to move with him. And Leslie's pissed off enough at the entire town and this scandal that she might actually do it, but she needs some time to think about it. Scandal gets worse when Joan Calamezzo has found 4-year-old footage of Dexart and Leslie shaking hands at an event, and is using it as proof that the sex scandal is real. They overanalyze 3 seconds of footage, and a straight-up spoof of that one time that Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky shook hands.
Look at the way she's smiling at him. Mm-hmm. And then almost unconsciously touching her hands to her hips. See that? Right there. It's like she's sending him a message that she's ready for childbearing.
When I overanalyze something, it's just stupid jokes from sitcoms. These people are nuts. Leslie drops a quote I should have used last week when explaining the Tiger Woods situation.
In a 24-hour news cycle, the tiniest story gets dissected over and over again. In 2004, a kid from Pawnee went to the Olympics, and it was reported on for over a year. He wasn't even competing or anything. He just was going literally to watch the Olympics.
And easily ropes Dexart into a meeting with Leslie, since he thinks he'll probably get laid. Dexart's choosing to lean into the Leslie scandal instead of letting the real, much worse scandal break. So Leslie finally goes on Pawnee Today to confront the rumors head on. When she's there, Joan pulls the old Jerry Springer trick and brings Dexart himself out. He has proof that they're sleeping together. Leslie has a mole on her butt cheek. Leslie, so fed up, calls Dexart's bluff and shows Joan her ass.
This exclusive story, there is no mole on Miss Nope.
I can't believe it's come to this. This is utterly humiliating.
Well, Councilman, care to make a comment about No Mole Gate?
Yes. I really didn't think that Miss Nope would pull down her pants on TV.
Clearly, Dexart doesn't know a thing about Leslie. Later that night, Leslie confesses to Dave that she can't go to San Diego with him. Despite its flaws, she still loves Pawnee too much to go. Thankfully, after already having to do my awkward conversation about Louis C.K. back during the Greg Pakaitis episode, this is the end of his guest run on Parks. So not only are Dave, Councilman Dexart, Joan Calamezzo, and Purd happily back for the first time in several weeks, so is Lot 48, as it's the site for Pawnee's Winter Wonderland, a name that's getting used a lot tonight. There's so many exciting events planned, like the tree lighting, which will be simulcast over internet radio.
That's a really big deal.
It is, thank you.
Listen to that tree lighting, it's gonna be dope.
Our B plot is the rest of the Parks Department agreeing to split up Leslie's tasks so she can lay low during the scandal.
Okay, I've made copies of Leslie's daily work schedule. So we'll just split into teams, and each team will take... damn, 10 items. And we'll knock this out.
Ron gets stuck in all the boring meetings that Leslie would usually have loved to have been in. Tom and Mark bailed on taking a case of beer to the sanitation department, but that was actually meant to be a favor, so the dumpster on Lot 48 doesn't get emptied and is now overrun by raccoons.
I thought raccoons were supposed to be nocturnal.
Not in this town, sweetheart. In this town, they're 24/7. We can't have raccoons for the Christmas thing. They'll hunt the kids for sport.
Our C plots involve getting advice for Christmas presents. Brandanowitz tells Tom that he got Anne a very nice practical laptop bag for Christmas. Tom thinks this is a terrible idea. A woman as hot as Anne needs diamonds. Better yet, conflict diamonds.
Even the super left-wing chicks that saw Blood Diamond and cried, when they get a diamond, they're like, yeah, bitch, give more than blood diamonds. Make him extra bloody. Trust me.
I feel like Tom would have fit in perfectly as a character in Avatar. April's going to Andy for advice about what she can get her gay boyfriend for Christmas. Yet another character that I almost completely have forgotten about. and he doesn't even show up on screen in this episode. Andy's heart is in the right place, but his suggestions are all just things that a dumb guy would think a gay teenager might want. April wants better ideas and asks Andy what sort of gift he would want for himself. In the end, Anne does get her laptop bag, and she's super excited about it. Anne gets Mark Pacers tickets, and Mark reveals that he got her a second present, not blood diamonds, but the gift of not having to go to a basketball game with him. Andy finds a gift for himself at the shoeshine stand, a Reggie Wayne jersey from April, which is just what he wanted. And despite not having Leslie around to help with the Winter Wonderland, it's very well received. Except the tree wasn't lit when she got there. It turns out that they were waiting for Leslie to show up so she could light the tree herself.
Okay, everybody, count down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, what? Did the tree lighting not sound good over internet radio? So there's a lot jammed into this episode, and a lot more than we've been seeing on Parks and Recreation recently. This is the Christmas episode, but where we saw community discuss potential awkwardness around spending the holidays with new friends with different beliefs, other than the few bits about buying gifts, the rest of this plot could have taken place any time of year. It reminds me a bit of 30 Rock's The Breakup from season 1, which is in no way a Christmas episode, other than it aired in December and has a brief Christmas moment at the end with Dennis giving Liz a Christmas present. Dave's last appearance seems very shoehorned in as well. I'd guess that Louis C.K. was already busy prepping for his own series, Louis, which premiered the following June, and they came up with something easy to write him off, which is why you only see him in a few scenes with only Leslie. Tom's mostly back on the sidelines this week, and Ron's too busy covering for Leslie for the whole Wendy Haverford situation to even be discussed. But Andy manages to be in a room with Anne and Mark and doesn't say anything to them at all. So maybe the story of Andy moving on is sticking. Instead, the blossoming friendship between April and Andy is back. And she doesn't just buy him a friend Christmas present. Authentic jerseys are incredibly expensive. Like, probably just as much as a nice computer bag. There's something brewing over there. You'd think I'd be more upset that the sex scandal episode took place a week after I talked about the Tiger Woods sex scandal. Maybe I should have held off on that story until this week. But a good scandal is just like Avatar. It's the kind of thing you can talk about for weeks and then completely forget about for the rest of your life. Secret Santa is Mindy Kaling's 15th of 22 writing credits on The Office, and her first since Niagara, making this my first opportunity to discuss how Kaling also starred on The Office as Kelly Kapoor, and she also would go on to direct 2 future episodes. Speaking of directors, get ready to hear about quite possibly the busiest man in television on December 10th, 2009, because this episode was also directed by Randall Einhorn. This being the 10th of 15 episodes of The Office that he directed. If you've been paying attention, and I hope you have, that's a Parks, an Office, and an Always Sunny all on the same night. Suck it, James Cameron. Randall Einhorn's the king of my world tonight. Before we get into it, the DVDs have an extended producer's cut. Netflix Canada only has the original 22-minute version. I'm oblivious to what Peacock is streaming, so I'm sticking to the original cut. It's a fantastic episode as it is, and I'm inclined to believe it's the closest to what originally aired on December 10th. We get our first reappearance of the Dwight and Jim Party Planning Committee since Charles Minor shut them down back in season 5. Charles is probably getting fired today if he hasn't already quit Dunder Mifflin, so I guess there's no one here to stop them. It's Christmas, which means we're about to see another terrible Dunder Mifflin party that only gets better after somebody learns a lesson. After agreeing to team up with Ryan last week, it is a little strange to see Dwight working with Jim.
My diabolical plot is on hold for Christmas. My heart just melts with the sound of children singing. Not really. I'm just tired. The days are short. I don't know. Maybe I'm depressed.
Just to set the tone for how bad the party will be, there's a tree reveal, just like at Rockefeller Center, you know, where 30 Rock is set. Boom. Successful show, Link. Nailed it. But unlike the tree we just saw in Pawnee, this one doesn't even have any lights on it. Jim told Phyllis weeks ago that she could play Santa, a decision that he didn't care about at all. But this has been one of Phyllis's dreams, and the whole office is excited to get to see her play the part. She says the party will be great, if you've been good. Creed's a little concerned.
What if you've been really, really bad, more evil than strictly wrong?
Hey, Creed, we covered it. Lump of coal.
Were you committing genocide on the alien moon of Pandora, Creed? No, then you're probably fine. But then again, he's probably still worried about being a murder suspect from a few weeks ago. When Michael, who's also dressed up like Santa, shows up for work and finds out for Phyllis, he throws a tantrum. With the state the company is in, he's worried this could be their last Christmas together, so he has a pathological need to play Santa. But Jim's not going to stop Phyllis now.
Fine, then do it anonymously, ransom note style. You can... you know what? I have a bunch of letters cut out of magazines in my desk. You can use those.
Let's forget about Creed. What kind of evil shit is Michael planning? Michael decides that he's going to set up his own chair for people to sit on his lap. The only person who bites is Kevin, since Phyllis wouldn't let him on her lap. Because, you know, physics.
There we go. Oh my god.
Oh, that's really comfortable.
What would you like for Christmas, little boy?
I don't know. I didn't know you were going to ask me that.
What did you think was going to happen?
I didn't know. Nobody's ever let me sit on their lap before.
All right, just say some toys, please.
This scene has gained a lot of notoriety over the years, since many cast members have revealed how they could not hold it together on set. And Mindy Kaling and Ed Helms are visibly breaking character and laughing in the background through this entire scene. Phyllis complains to Jim about Michael.
You promised me this. Don't make me get Bob involved.
What would Bob do?
Never mind, I shouldn't have said that.
First Creed, then Michael, now Bob Vance. What kind of mob shit is he up to? Jim ultimately puts Santa up to a vote. And when the only other vote for Michael comes from Dwight, Michael throws his hat in the punch bowl and goes to sulk in his office. Meanwhile, Secret Santa has been going on apparently for several days leading up to this party. Dwight's Secret Santa has been gifting small parts to a machine to assemble, and Dwight makes a public announcement that he's still missing vital parts to complete what he believes to be a gun.
Oh, I don't have all the pieces yet.
Well, unless the missing pieces is a gun, you don't have a gun.
I paused the show at this moment to write down Stanley's quote for my notes. And I inadvertently paused on Dwight's list of guesses of what the contraption might be. And it's something I've never noticed before. He crosses off gun, and he's already ruled out that it's not a lathe, an aardvark trap, a possum trap, a lobster trap, or a man trap. But it still might be a beaver, chipmunk, or skunk trap, an abdominizer, or a speculum. Speculum is probably the best guess on that list. If only it was a bird trap, maybe Dwight could help Aaron. Aaron shows up to work with a scratch face, and while she appreciates the effort that her Secret Santa has been gifting her everything listed in the song The 12 Days of Christmas, she begs whomever it is to stop. Turns out it was Andy, who had her name, and he begged Jim and Dwight to get it.
Is it my fault that the first 8 days there's basically 30 birds?
Also, let's note that this is the second Russ Griswold we've seen tonight, since Ed Helms would go on to play the character in the 2015 Vacation revival. And while I'm down that rabbit hole, Chevy Chase would also cameo in it, along with Charlie Day and Caitlin Olson from It's Always Sunny, Nick Kroll from The League, and it was co-directed and co-written by John Francis Daly, who plays Sweets on Bones. Why am I even bringing this up, other than to mention all these connections? Because I've definitely seen Vacation more times than I've seen Avatar. Back in 2009, the party starts without Michael, who's continuing to sulk. So he flips his Santa coat inside out, and now it's a white robe. He comes back out of his office, ready to play Jesus, to only Angela's delight. Toby steps in.
Wow, Michael, like, this must be obvious. How wrong this is.
Oh, the Antichrist.
Okay, you can't... Ow, look.
Toby says that they can't push religion, so clearly, he also saw tonight's episode of Community. Phyllis Claus is handing out the final Secret Santa gifts, and a depressed Michael is doing commentary via the karaoke machine. And after he outs Andy as Aaron's Secret Santa, Jim shuts him down. Michael calls David Wallace to complain, saying he's sitting there, dressed as Jesus.
Because Phyllis, a woman, has usurped my role as Santa.
Wallace has no shits to give, because he's found out that Dunder Mifflin has a buyer, and they're cleaning house. Wallace, Alan the CEO, and the entire board are getting fired. Perhaps the smartest thing we ever see Wallace do is to just say, goodbye, Michael, and stop taking his calls. Michael sheepishly comes out of his office, now dressed just as himself, and asks how everyone is doing.
Not great. You heckled Santa for an hour and a half.
That was a different guy. That was Jesus. Jesus sort of ruined the party. Hurt petulant Jesus.
Michael sends Dwight off with his debit card to go buy pizzas to help turn the party around. While apologizing, Michael can't help himself from revealing that Dunder Mifflin is getting sold. Pretty instant mood killer for the Christmas party, but Jim catches on pretty quickly that being sold does not mean they're going out of business. After pretending to be Wallace's daughter to get him to answer a phone call, the entire branch gathers in Michael's office to hear the news. Wallace tells them that they're all fine. The buyer wants Dunder Mifflin's distribution, and the branches are the only thing that is working right. They don't even wait for a morose Wallace to hang up, before the entire office celebrates, and we finally get a legit Dunder Mifflin Christmas party, with karaoke and weird presents. Dwight learns that his present is actually a nutcracker after Michael drops off a bag of nuts on his desk, revealing that the gift was from him all along. Michael sits on Phyllis's lap to make amends. Bob Vance finally shows up, also dressed like Santa and ready to fight, but Phyllis calls him off, and we get to see two Santas make out, so that's fun. The other runner through this entire episode, which is a very loose C-plot, is that Oscar is obsessing about the new gay warehouse employee, Matt. Pam spends the episode trying to push them together, since it's 2009, and she only knows two gay guys, so they should be together. After a lot of awkwardness, Oscar finally ends the party by calling him Mark.
I know what I'm doing, Pam.
Andy's determined to make up for all the birds with Aaron, and out in the parking lot at the end of the night, Aaron gets her final gift, a drum line of 12 drummers drumming. Andy's pursuit of Aaron gets some attention after several weeks of nothing brewing, and it looks like it's ready to become a bigger plot point. What they've finally gotten better at is telling a story of Michael and Jim being at odds as co-managers. Nobody is questioning Jim's authority anymore, not since he put Ryan in the supply closet. Jim's making decisions, calling shots, and when he butts heads with Michael, Michael is not talking down to him anymore. And with Dwight stating at the start of the episode that he's taking a break on trying to bring down Jim, it looks like it'll be a little bit longer before we see the Ryan-Dwight alliance truly form. Something else this episode has, and it's something I feel like we haven't seen at all in the last 8 episodes, is a lot of small interconnected stories. Oscar's pursuit of Matt, Dwight's mystery machine, and Aaron's bird attacks are a lot of smaller subplots than we've been seeing lately. And having so many characters involved in so many small stories makes it all feel so much more like the ensemble show that we've been seeing in the past. The Office has set a pretty high bar when it comes to Christmas episodes, and shit always goes down at the Christmas party. This year was no exception, and despite the seemingly happy ending, who knows what Dunder Mifflin is going to look like when we come back in January. The ending is reminiscent of Season 3's Benihana Christmas, with Michael getting someone to agree to go to Jamaica with him, but we don't find out who it was until we come back in the new year. And likewise, it's going to be the same story with whomever bought Dunder Mifflin. Maybe it's the Resources Development Administration. What's that, you're asking? Oh, it's just the mining company from Avatar. I had to look that up on Wikipedia. I'm still not rewatching that movie. In the culmination of weird coincidences that have happened tonight, 30 Rock's episode is also titled Secret Santa. And would you believe that it was also directed by Randall Einhorn? You shouldn't, because it wasn't, but man, that would have been a wild coincidence. No, we've got yet another episode directed by Beth McCarthy Miller, her 9th of 23, and it was written by Tina Fey, somewhere in the middle of the pack of the 31 episodes she wrote. Considering how Parks and Recreation was written by one of its co-creators as well tonight, I'll call that one out as a tenuous coincidence. I mentioned it earlier, but I'm going to say this is technically only 30 Rock's third Christmas episode. While season 1's The Breakup briefly mentions it being Christmas, we've seen Ludachristmas in season 2 and Christmas Special in season 3. While The Office bases its Christmas episodes around the Dunder Mifflin staff party, each of 30 Rock's Christmas episodes is something entirely different. We open with great continuity that Liz's hair is still growing out from last week's 3 different haircuts. Cerie's helping Liz with her Christmas shopping when Liz realizes that she's never exchanged gifts with Jack before. She goes up to Jack's office to discuss the matter, but first, Jack reveals that they've acquired a new social networking site called YouFace. Liz is not hopping on the YouFace bandwagon.
Those sites are for horny married chicks with kids who want to exchange pervy emails with their old high school boyfriends.
And since all your high school boyfriends are now gay...
Exactly!
That reminds me of the story that Annie told us last week on Community. But remember what social media was like before the youths took them over? They were mostly just being used to destroy marriages. Jack would love to exchange gifts with Liz. Liz is ready for the two of them to just tell each other what they both want, but it turns out that Jack takes gift-giving as a very pure expression of friendship. We also come to learn from Jonathan that he has tried and failed to keep up with Jack over the years.
He is the best gift-giver in the world. I tried once. I bought him a $95 bottle of olive oil. In return, he got my sister out of a North Korean jail.
So Liz is going to have her work cut out for her. As YouFace is taking off, Jack's old schoolmate Nancy Donovan has finger-tagged him. Remember poking people on Facebook? Remember how you'd get into poking wars with people? There's somebody out there who poked you and you never poked them back. Good luck sleeping tonight thinking about that. Liz isn't surprised Jack found an old girlfriend, but Jack says they never dated. She was just Jack's first crush, while Liz's first crush was Larry Wilcox from Chips. Nancy messages Jack to say she's in town and she's going to swing by to see him, which is a loaded message. Luckily, they have Cerie, who's so young, her mother was born the same year Jack graduated high school, and she's immediately caught on to the dynamics of how YouFace works. She tells Jack that Nancy's marital status changed to working on it 14 days ago. Meanwhile, Liz has tried to find the YouFace website on her desktop, but she spells it with a hyphen, which is a huge mistake.
There are definitely faces here, but they are not being treated with respect.
Nancy has come to visit, and Jack introduces her to Liz. And even through the thick Boston accent, Liz can see the sparks are flying. Nancy and Jack go for a walk around Rockefeller Plaza, make plans for dinner, and talk about missing out on never kissing in high school, except for every single night when they were in the school play together. Afterwards, Cerie is showing Jack that Nancy has uploaded pictures from her day onto YouFace, but she's cropped Jack out of all of them, and this means she feels weird about him, but in a good way.
Like going to the gym drunk.
And in bigger news, she's changed her marital status again from working on it to weirdsies. Liz shows up with a present for Jack, and she's bought Jack the exact same tie that he is currently wearing. So Jack gives Liz an out. They can't spend any money on their gifts. And Liz is excited about getting to be creative.
Well, you are the one that's in trouble now, buddy, because creativity to me is just like, it's like a bird, like a friendly bird that embraces all ideas and just like shoots out of its eyes all kinds of beauty.
Liz was at least on the right track because the tie in question is Jack's lucky tie, which he's putting on for his dinner date with Nancy. Dinner goes well enough, but Nancy has to turn in since she has to get her kids up for the early train to Boston in the morning.
You know how hard it is to get teenagers out of bed in the morning.
Oh, yes, but not in the way you're talking about.
As Jack's lamenting what could have been, Liz has written a song for Jack as his present, but she gives up halfway through because they both know it's terrible. Jack's not even in the mood to insult her. For once, he's homesick for Boston, and he realizes this was all a fleeting moment that he wished could have lasted a little bit longer. Meanwhile, Kenneth is organizing a studio-wide Secret Santa as the episode's B-plot. So not only did 30 Rock and The Office both have the same title, Secret Santa is also only the episode's B-plots at best. The writers want nothing to do with the gift exchange.
Ugh, he takes the two worst parts of Christmas, giving and rules, and combines them.
So they decide to lie to Kenneth and say that they do not celebrate Christmas because they belong to a new religion they've invented on the spot, Verdukianism. Kenneth takes the news that his friends have a different religion much better than Shirley did. Tracy finds Kenneth setting up some multi-denominational decorations, including
a picture of President Obama
for the Muslims.
Gonna let that one slide.
The writers are celebrating the Verdukian holiday of Merlinpeen, but Tracy can smell through their bullshit. Tracy tells Kenneth that the writers are lying about Verdukianism to get out of Secret Santa, but Kenneth can't believe it. They have this whole list of rules, but Tracy says they're made up, just like every other religion's.
Why don't Catholics eat meat on Fridays? I'll tell you why. Because the Pope owns Long John Silver's.
Alright, I was getting worried that Tracy was being the only sensible person in this episode. But this sends Kenneth into a crisis of faith. The writers try to apologize, but Kenneth is too far gone, and he's going to go buy some guitar music since he lives in a world without consequences. The C-plot, believe it or not, involves Danny Baker. Danny's concerned because he hasn't been on the show in 2 weeks. He must be talking about TGS, because we haven't seen him on 30 Rock in over a month. Pete's too busy being pissed off at Jenna for never chipping in on the gifts from the cast and writers, until he finds out that Danny is a beautiful singer. Pete gets mad that Danny's never brought it up before.
I didn't think it was important.
Not important, I had Tracy playing Josh Groban last week.
Pete decides he's going to get vengeance on Jenna by giving Danny the Christmas solo on this week's TGS. But Danny doesn't want to hog the spotlight, so he suggests a duet, which excites Pete even more.
Yes, a duet. Share the stage. She will love that.
I'm sorry, are you being sarcastic? Canadians have a hard time recognizing it because we don't have a big Jewish population.
Neither of those are true. Canada has the fourth largest Jewish population in the world, and the third by capita. And thanks for using the whole word, Danny. Danny goes on to tell Jenna about the duet. And when Danny sings for Jenna and she hears how good he is, she gets a nosebleed.
It's definitely not a rage stroke.
We learn that Jenna's had a lot of childhood trauma when it comes to Christmas. So when it comes time for the Christmas duet, Danny sings off-key on purpose to make Jenna sound better. And poor Pete just never gets a win. To wrap things up, Nancy shows up to Jack's office after she's already supposed to be gone since her train got canceled. And she figures she owes Jack a goodbye kiss. It turns out that this was Liz's gift to Jack, since she called in a bomb threat that canceled Nancy's train. This leads to the cops showing up to arrest Frank and Topher, since the bomb threat was made from their phone.
I renounce Verdukianism!
What? What's that mean? Are you Al-Qaeda? Come here, pal!
With the writers getting punished by an angry god, Kenneth's faith is restored. In the end, Jack refuses to be outdone and gets the real Larry Wilcox to show up in character for Liz outside of 30 Rock. Liz wonders how Jack got this for free.
Well, he promised to get me on Dancing with the Stars.
But that's on ABC.
Donaghy!
So that's the new record for how many drops I've played in one segment, because this episode had some amazing one-liners. From top to bottom, it's a solid episode. With Deal Breakers looking like it's officially dead, Liz's storyline tonight was pretty self-contained. But Jack's found himself a new love interest. And I honestly can't tell if Julianne Moore's Boston accent is terrible or fantastic. It actually kind of sounds like the accent Alec Baldwin does in The Departed. Liz and Jack's friendship has had a very rough go this entire season. So it's a welcome change to see them actively doing good for one another for the entire episode. And I'm glad they're using Danny after devoting so many early episodes just to finding him. We didn't get to see Wendy Haverford this week, so I'm just happy to see a Canadian on the screen. Except he's not played by a Canadian. I dug deep. The only other Canadian I can find on tonight's programming is John Lajoie, Taco from the League. You know, maybe I shouldn't have been so hard on Avatar, since it was directed by Canadian James Cameron. Tracy's quest for a baby girl in the EGOT has been put on ice this week. He's not even wearing that necklace. Maybe, like Dwight, he's feeling drained by the shorter days. But at least he gets to play the straight man against Kenneth and the writers. And, by the way, it's really weird how close Verdukianism sounds to Verukiism. You know, that tree-based religion from Avatar? I'm completely making that up, but admit it, you had no idea I was lying, did you?
Review.
Comparative Religion scored an A from the AV Club and an 8.5 from IGN. Much more alignment than we saw last week. I have to laugh at IGN's assumption that Community may have stepped its game up from the last few episodes after a strongly worded note from the network. I'll make the bold statement that nothing great about Community was ever the result of a note from the network. Oddly enough, I feel like IGN finally got the point this week, when in the past, I've noticed they missed all the interconnections between the plot lines. But they hit the nail on the head tonight. The story here is that the agnostic is teaching the lesson on turning the other cheek. The AV Club's a little worried that Jeff's evolution into a more caring character hasn't started to hurt the show yet, but it could break the formula that has been working. And that's why I read these reviews, to get this perspective. We wanted the show to continue to build to the potential of its cast, its characters, and this setting, but there's a bit of fear that it could eventually lose its charm. But it certainly hasn't yet. Christmas Scandal scored an A- from the AV Club and an 8.4 from IGN. Something I'm learning is that Parks is much less polarizing than the other NBC series, and we get a lot of the same analysis in both reviews, which makes me feel smart because I picked up on a lot of the same stuff. This is a very busy episode, pushing forward multiple narratives, some with only a few scenes, but it manages to work well. We've seen Joan before, we've seen Dexart before, so we can get to the point quickly with a lot of these characters to just get to the jokes, which is why this show just keeps getting better and better. This episode could have easily gone off the rails, but it can flex into all sorts of directions because the background is, it's Christmas time, and that helps keep everything on track. It's not that the show is using it as a crutch, but rather, it's able to take full advantage of that creative space that a Christmas episode can allow for. The Office's Secret Santa also got high marks, another A- from the AV Club, and an 8.7 from IGN. I agree with these write-ups, since I also enjoyed this episode, but both reviews lean very much into It's Christmas in Dunder Mifflin, so that's fun. And it's the same formula they've used since the first Christmas episode, coincidentally also written by Michael Schur, who again wrote tonight's Parks and Recreation. The Christmas party gets ruined, we wallow in some misery, then someone comes along and fixes it. The fresh take this year is that everyone is legitimately excited that their jobs are just about as secure as they ever have been, which is not really something that the Dunder Mifflin employees usually get excited about. But they may not even be Dunder Mifflin employees by next year, but at least they'll still all be together. We start seeing dissension in the reviews when we get to 30 Rock Secret Santa, with the lowest scores of the night. It got a respectable 8.1 from IGN, but only a B- from the AV Club, with the B- score being outright stated as a Christmas gift from the reviewer. I'm siding with IGN here because this episode is goofy, it's machine gun quick, and is giving the entire cast something to do. Even minor characters like Suri and Jonathan. It's beginning to utilize Danny and gives an amazing actress like Julianne Moore a terrific guest spot. The criticism from the AV Club is really centered around wanting to see more out of Jenna, Kenneth, and the writers, but we're at fourth season levels of flanderizations with all of them. It's the natural progression. If you want your characters to say zany things constantly, they're going to lose their realistic edges. I actually picked up on the counter to this, to the point where I didn't find it believable that Tracy didn't fall for Verdukianism himself. And, just for fun, the AV Club gave Avatar a C, and IGN gave it a 9. And just like how I'm not rewatching Avatar, I didn't bother reading either of those reviews. It goes to show popularity at a moment in time doesn't parlay into enduring appeal. But I'm just one person. It's not like Universal Studios has a Dunder Mifflin themed area, the way Disney World opened Pandora, the world of Avatar, a few years back. I mean, they should, and I'd go there in a heartbeat. The best us Comedy Night Done Right fans have is the NBC gift shop at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. And maybe the story's not over for Avatar yet, since Avatar 2 finished filming last year, and there's a total of 4 sequels planned over the next 8 years. What's curious to me is how much longer the Christmas special is going to last. As long as we have network television, we'll see it in some fashion. It'd be foolish of me to say that streaming doesn't cater to this. Plenty of streaming series feature episodes that take place at Christmas, regardless of what time of year they're released. Some straight up do special Christmas releases. Just to keep up with the Canadian content, half of Letterkenny's seasons are released on Christmas Day, and they finally only did a one-off Christmas special back in 2018. Or you could take BoJack Horseman, for example, who's also voiced by a Canadian, Will Arnett, which released a Christmas special after its first season, where BoJack and Todd watched the Horsing Around Christmas special in an episode dripping with meta-referential humor. But I can't understate the magic of turning on the TV and having all the shows you watch on one night give us their take on Christmas. It's a great escape when Christmas isn't as great as you hoped it would be. Whether you have family problems like Shirley, or you're getting fired like David Wallace, it's not like the world's troubles stop in December. But television can be a reprieve. This year was a one and done, though, since these four shows never aired simultaneously at Christmas time ever again, because NBC didn't seem to know what it had on its hands. It would be 5 long weeks before Comedy Night Done Right returned on January 14th, 2010. However, the next episode of this podcast is going to be a little bit different since there was a slight programming tweak. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time to discuss Community's investigative journalism, Parks and Recreation's The Setup, and there's no new Office, but instead, two new 30 Rocks, Klaus and Greta, and Blacklight Attack. When I originally conceived of this podcast, I was going to skip all the nights we didn't get all four series. But considering how all hell is about to break loose over The Tonight Show, NBC's aimlessness is going to a whole new level, and I need to talk about it. This has been Comedy Night Podcasted Right, written, recorded, produced, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Matt Cale. I make the music, I make the artwork, I run the social media accounts. Follow the show on Twitter at Comedy Night Pod 1, on Instagram at Comedy Night Podcasted Right. Join the subreddit at reddit.com/r/ComedyNightPodRight, or follow me as user Comedy Night Podcast. You can email me about anything or everything at ComedyNightPodcast@gmail.com, especially if you have hard feelings about Avatar and didn't appreciate how much I picked on it this episode. And I know I'm really behind the times here, but if you really need to finger tag me, I'm on YouFace as well. Check out my Face Vault for tons of fun bing bangs. Well, that's it. We've made it through 2009. Let's pop a bottle of champagne and celebrate with a toast.
Merry holiday.
Actually, I was going to say merry semester and happy new one.
Switch.
Next class.
Okay, he's running out.
Oh, my God.